gone a little bit.
Spread the Grail. But before I go into the specifics of the Grail, I just want to go over some of the principles, really, by which we're investigating these myths. As I said yesterday, we're looking at it from a specifically esoteric viewpoint, not a sociological or a literary viewpoint. What we're looking at is these myths as teaching, as archetypal teaching stories. Now, archetypes are these great matrices that ultimately come out of the if you like, the divine imagination. And it's why very often when you compare myths against each other, you can identify common patterns that emerge in different dialects and different histories. And there is obviously a temptation, particularly when we're looking at things like the medieval myths, to treat them as stories of our time or novels, and it's very easy to segue into that. But actually, that isn't that. None of the apparent men or women in the Arthurian stories are actual men or women. They're not illustrating relationships between men and women, or even between political castes. Now, you can, of course, because they're written by human beings, you can interpret them in that way. But fundamentally, they are initiatory documents that are showing us the relationship of our own soul to the soul of the world. And in a certain sense, if we think of the Arthurian myth, for example, in relationship to the Tree of Life, which we will increasingly do as we move along, but even a very cursory look at it, if we think of if we think of Camelot as the place of the kingdom being in Malchut. It is surrounded by the wild wood, the mysterious place, so the forest of Brocélande, that in a certain sense is both Yesod and De'art, but at this point Yesod. If we think of the castle of the king that contains the round table as being in Tiferet, we can think of the Grail Chapel as being in De'art. And we can think of the city of Saras, which is the place where the Grail's natural home is, as being in Qetar. So that's one way of starting to... Because what do you do when you look at... I mean, mythical stories are not written like esoteric architecture. The story is designed to take us places and often frustrates us and gives us puzzles and gives us things to kind of wrestle with. But the Tree of Life is very good for helping us illuminate the quandaries and the possibilities. So at one level, if we look at places, we can place some of the places of the Arthurian myth on the tree in that way. We can also look, for example, at some of the placement of the people. Now, Arthur is, of course, into the king in Tiferet. He is the center point. The Lancelot, by contrast, is somewhere in Netzach, the lover, the victorious knight who is the lover, who also has a connection with Geburah. Because he is the best knight in all the world. Galahad is a figure that comes out of De'art, because he is the that we'll talk more about Galahad today. The Morgan is, in a way, Morgan sits both in Hod, because she is the enchantress, she's the woman of magic, but also sits in Bina. Guinevere is both the figure of Netzach and in Bina. And so the temptation sometimes when you use the tree to help you understand a myth is to pigeonhole a figure or shape into one sphere or one constellation. Now, the helpfulness of the tree is it can help, because figures have multiple roles and multiple identities. So, for example, say we place Guinevere on the tree. What is that? Okay, don't know what that was.
Sorry, I think that was somebody trying to call me. I've got some...
Oh, okay.
Connection. I'm not sure how to undo it on my phone, but...
Okay. No worries, it's gone. So, say we place Guinevere upon the tree. We have the underneath intention, the being that, to use the phrase of Charles Williams, that which was Guinevere, the deep soul of Guinevere, that has the intention of who Guinevere will be, shall be. We have her father as King Leod of Rance, who is in Hocmar, and who gives her the Round Table. She herself is primordially a figure both of Bina and of Malkut. So we think that, remember that Hocmar is the sphere of the stars, and also therefore connected to the idea of the zodiac in the medieval mind. And we think that one of the deep archetypes of the Round Table is the circle of the zodiac. So Leodegrance gives to her his daughter Guinevere, who is the deep feminine here, gives to her the image of the Round Table. She enters enters into connection with Arthur in Tiferet and establishes the table. Now there's a whole set of stories around Guinevere, about Guinevere being abducted and rescued. So there are these martial elements that oppose. So Guinevere represents this quality of the quality of the divine feminine of creating balance and beauty. So her activity is very much in Gedula, in promoting growth and life and fertility and magic. But there is this quality of across from her, if we think of Gevura, there's this place where that quality is constantly in attack, and she gets taken away from her role by these various figures that abduct her, and then is defended by various knights, principally Lancelot, of course. And we see that working through right at the end of the story. Now, as far as the higher elements of the tree goes, the whole Guinevere's tree is completely balanced. The problem starts to come is when we come down into the lower triangle of the tree, specifically in Netzach, where because of the inattentiveness, the error of Arthur, instead of the relationship between Guinevere and Arthur being this fruitful relationship, there is a breaking of relationship. And then what happens, instead of Netzach operating as it's in its balanced desire nature, which creates new ideas, new life, new growth, new, literally new life, as in Yesod that manifests in Malkut, the current of life energy becomes diverted, because it's diverted into the cul-de-sac of Lancelot and Guinevere. And therefore there is an insufficient grounding of the idea of the round table, which is the archetype around which all of Camelot takes shape. So you see a distortion happening in that archetype, and a partial grounding. Because the grounding of Camelot is accomplished by a kind of collusion between Arthur and Guinevere and Lancelot, where Arthur pretends not to know, not to notice. And this is, in a way, the place. And so this is what you see here, really, is the desire nature of Netzach not being honored in its proper place. And this is not about morality. This is about esoteric dynamics, where the union, really, of the king and the queen and their desire each for each other, and the fertilization, really, that comes through Hod and Netzach. Now, Hod and Netzach at the base of the tree are like a reverberating circuit. That's where the god name is Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh Zabaet, Elohim Tzabaet. It's the multiplication place. It's where the principles of creation multiply. The one becomes the many. Now, if there's a problem in that reverberation, if it is not balanced, then the forms that arise out of it in Yesod, which are the forms, the preconscious forms, the forms that are in the etheric, that come down into matter, are not balanced forms. Now, they're not appallingly distorted here, but they are distorted. And there's a sort of an imbalance that then works it briefly, which then allows the Klipotic tree. And here we have the, in a certain sense, you could say that what happens is that we have the shadow side of Morgan Le Fay, who's operating in Yesod and Hod, as the moon, as the enchantress and enchantress seductress, and also the challenger of Arthur. So that they feel like the shadow Morgan rather than the Morgan who also is a figure of Bina. Then the cross starts to create a disturbance, and Arthur's desire energy, instead of being directed at Guinevere, ends up being directed at Morgan. It's actually in the book, it's Morgars, but she's also a copy, a replica of Morgan in lots of ways. So just for simplicity, we'll just keep using Morgan as a placeholder for that. We'll get into the details later on. Now, as a result of both the diversion, instead of the desire nature of the king and the queen coming together and creating the balanced reverberation of Hod and Netzach, and then the creation of the living icons that descend into Malkut in balanced form, we have the creation, we have the, if you like, the cul-de-sac of Lancelot and Guinevere, which, although very romantic sounding, and it actually just leads to disaster. But in Arthur's, the diversion of Arthur's desire, nature, and energy leads to the creation of Mordred. So you see here, really, how the tree can really kind of help us look at some of the underlying dynamics. Because what subsequently happens as a result of the this kind of disturbance, of course, is that Mordred, who becomes and Mordred, you know, it's just interesting if you think here of Morgan Le Fay as operating out of Hod, operating as the wicked sorceress, and herself now separated from her deeper place as the initiator and the challenger of Arthur. Now in that place where then she uses her seductive energy, so we could do a whole thing by placing Morgan on the tree and see how that works out. But you see a function here really, creates in Yesod this form of Mordred, who is so if Arthur is the magical child who appears really in Da'at, and who takes his place in Tiferet, Mordred is the sort of the antitype, the Clipotic child born of the broken relationship between Arthur and Guinevere, and the relationship with Morgan. And so he appears as an idol in Morgan. Mordred appears as an idol in Yesod, who wishes to seize the crown, the kingdom, the table for himself, and who seduces the people of Camelot, the beings of Malfoot, to elevate him to the place of the kingship, as opposed to that place where we surrender and allow the unveiling light to show us the true kingship within ourselves and within the world. And in a way, that's where the tree can be very helpful to us in this, right? Where you can't, not in a mechanical sense of, well, that bit of the story is that bit, fear. So what you do, it's like a poetic process where you feel into the sense of the tree and the dynamics of the tree. And then you can look at a situation, look at the, you know, and then you start to see, well, how does this relate to that? Where do they sit upon the tree? And if we look at Arthur himself, in a sense, really, we started by looking at Guinevere. We start alternately and look at Arthur. Where the story begins, really, is in the abyss, in the place where everything is in confusion and darkness and there is no centre to anything. So in a sense, almost the deepest place is even before manifestation. So the story is, you know, so there is no king, no crown, no centre, no balance. And again, if you remember, we're looking at this, we're not looking at political systems, we're not looking at monarchies or whether monarchies are good or bad, or it's again, these are the principles of the difference between this place of chaos and this place of the manifestation of the name, which is the manifestation of life, of light, of love, of law. And the king, or the center, is the center point, the administrator, the mediator of these kind of principles. He is the king priest who links the different worlds together. He, she, it's not a masculine thing, it's a role, you know, so it's a role in the Bible, the archetypal figure is Melchizedek, the king and priest forever. But it's, again, these are not people, these are principles. So anyone can be Melchizedek, anyone can be Arthur. And anciently, we have to remember that the name Arthur has a connection, really, with the ancient image of the bear. And the figure in the Mabinogion of Math Sandamathonmi, the one who is bear-like, the one who is the bear. And if you remember, if any of you are familiar with the county arms of Worcestershire, what you have is the bear and the ragged staff. which is the bear standing up, protecting the staff, which is the tree of life. So in a certain sense, and more shamanically, we see that Arthur is the bear figure, protecting the world, protecting the tree of life. And in the medieval story, what we have is this magical conception. So we have the will of Kolkata to bring balance and order out of chaos. We have in Hokma, we have Utha Pendragon, Utha, who is the head of the dragon. In Bina, we have Igraine. Arthur is the magical child who appears into art. Was given into the hands of Merlin, and he is, on the one hand, taken in. He is then taken into the household of Sir Ector, where his wife and he. He is loved and nourished by. So his foster mother, trained in arms by his foster father. And into art, trained in the ways of the wildwoods by Merlin. Before he reveals himself in Tiferet by the drawing of the sword. And by the drawing of the sword and by proclaiming the kingship and proclaiming the oneness, what then happens is the third triangle of the tree comes into being, where the Klepotic, and so we come first of all really into the reverberation of Hod and Netzach, where we get the revolt of the northern kings and northern tribes. We have the rallying to him of the companions of the, well, it's not yet the table hasn't fully come into being. And this comes together in a certain sense, really, of a great battle in Yesod, which is the battle between the icons and the idols, which eventually comes into a place of victory, which is the beginning of the founding of Camelot. And then, if you want to continue the story of Arthur, then you have to continue, because you've sort of run out of tree at this point, because you've come to one iteration of the cycle. Then the following iteration of the cycle would take us to Guinevere, and where we began, and the creation of the table, and then the end of the table. Now there's lots of ways we can do that. I've just sketched a very quick overview of the whole thing, like it is the story yesterday. But what that can help us do is to help us understand the inner principles behind the stories. And remind us that we're not reading a story that's about sociology or romantic love, but it uses the elements of all those stories to help us understand the connection between inner practice, inner process, and these outer aspects of ourselves, and these outer aspects within the world. Now, I want to come today to look at the two pieces of music played at the beginning. First is it's called Arthur and Sir Bedivere. It's from a small suite of music, quite a late suite of music by Edward Elgar, called his King Arthur Suite. It's not very often played, and it's a very beautiful piece of music. But in the Arthurian story, Sir Bedivere, who's always overlooked in lots of ways, is worth noticing, because he, along with Lancelot and Guinevere, he is one of the few survivors of the fall of Camelot. And he, in a certain sense, is the last person to wield Excalibur, the Sword of Light. And he is the one who returns Excalibur into the hands of the Lady of the Lake. And in a certain sense, Bedivere is the final witness to the whole, because Bedivere is the only person who sees Arthur's return to Avalon. And so he is the one, the only person who knows the whole of the story. In a sense, not even Lancelot and Guinevere know that, because they're not privy to that last piece where Arthur, because, you know, as far back as in the early Welsh traditions, you get this way, in the stanzas of the grave, you get where all the great Welsh heroes, British heroes rather, eulogise and we're told where their graves are. The one thing we're told about Arthur is there is no grave for Arthur. Arthur vanishes out of the world because he is the once and future king. And as the once and future king, he is the one who has been, but he is the one that can come at any time, because he is in the mysterious place of Avalon, which is not Glastonbury, but is adjacent to Glastonbury in a particular way. And it's named, the name of Avalon itself comes from Avel, which is the word of apple. So it is the place of apples, or the Apple Island. And that in itself has a connection with the Garden of Eden and the apple trees of Eden. So there's a lot of resonances, mythical resonances, back and forth here, which we can kind of look into as and when we want to. And so that nice piece, for me anyway, nice piece of music at the beginning, just which connects me to Bedivere, is that Bedivere is somebody that is worth contemplating. And that last piece of the story where at the Mort d'Arthur, where it looks like it's all gone now, really, isn't it? It's, you know, it's all gone terribly wrong, chaps. You know, everybody's dead. No king at all now, and in a sense, it can easily feel like nothing has been accomplished. But the whole point of this story, the whole point of Tennyson's phrase of lest one good custom should corrupt the world, is that what we're involved in is a continual iteration and reiteration that spirals. It's not a circular movement, it's a spiral motion. So that things are, when the new impulse emerges, it emerges on a slightly higher arc each time. The other piece of music that played really was a Jennifer Hill's very beautiful version of the Corpus Christi carol. And this has very particular relevance to our subject today and the Grail and the idea of the Sangreal and some of the deeper ideas behind Arthur. The Grail itself is this, we think of it as a cup, Mallory ends up thinking of it as the cup of the Last Supper. But actually it is the vessel that brings healing, refreshment and transformation. And it's connected back to some very ancient mysteries. And and as usual, the folk imagination is always interesting, really. So folk songs are interesting. Certainly some of the magical folk songs are very interesting. We've looked at intervals at the Thomas Rhymer and Tamlin. And in a way that folk carol has a direct resonance with both of these folk songs. If you remember, in Tamlin, the figure in Tamlin, the central figure in Tamlin is Fair Janet, who goes to Carter Hall, where there is a magical spring arising out of the ground, and guarded by this magical fairy being called Tamlin. We later learn is a Christian knight who has been taken into fairy by the Queen of the Fairies. And she summons Tamlin by plucking the red rose. And we're not told, but the inference is that he makes love to her, makes her pregnant. And then there's a whole process in the ballad where the king wants to give her in marriage to somebody, and she very powerfully says, "My babe is my own, and no man's, I'm owned by no man." But then she runs back to the place where she finds Tamlin in Carter Hall, and threatens to pluck the white rose, the rose of death, the rose that will cause the abortion. So she engages with the energies of life and death and summons Tamlin again. And there's this very powerful thing of and so in a certain sense we have her, in a sense, standing in Malchut, summoning the fairy lover from Yesod, in order to, and working with the energies of life and death, it is to, in a sense, to bring the kind of the invisible world into the visible. So there's this powerful incursion. She learns from Tamlin that on Halloween, where the fairies ride, if she stands at a crossroads, at Miles Cross, she'll see them pass, and if she notices the knight with a gold star in his crown, which would be the pentagram, the archetypal symbol of a human being, and if she on a milk white steed, and if she drags him down and brings him underneath her mantle, and she can bring him out of fairyland, and then there's this power. She does this. There's this powerful sequence of transformations, which results in him becoming a naked knight. And in a sense there's this enormous fusion of the masculine and feminine. But in a certain sense he becomes her child. So the primary energy here is the mother and the child. It's not a romantic relationship in that sense. And it is, mystically, it's quite potent where the child is the father of himself. In a certain kind of way. So far, Tamlin. The next ballad we see is the ballad of Thomas the Rhymer, because the ballad of Tamlin ends with the Queen of Fairy cursing the couple, and so there's something unresolved here. So the next ballad begins with Thomas the Rhymer, with him asleep under the hawthorn tree. So he's asleep in Yesod. The hawthorn tree is one of these magical trees, the entrance into fairy. And he hears the jingling of a horse and this figure that rides over the hill, so rides ultimately actually from the art down through Tiferet into the dreaming place where he is. And he thinks she's the Queen of Heaven, but she very specifically says, "No, I'm the Queen of Fairy." And she puts, and he agrees to go with her, and she puts him up behind her. And in contrast to the kind of activity of Janet, he is very passive. It's interesting, these two ballads, the feminine in Tamlin, very active. In Thomas Rhymer, the feminine, the masculine, very passive. So she's carried with her. And they have done, they wade, a lot of things done, but they wade through the river of blood and the river of tears, becoming wet to the knee. So it's like they immerse themselves in this otherworldly river before coming to the place of the tree in the garden of the tree, which is different. And he offers an apple on the tree. This is a reversal, really, of the Eden story at this point, where instead of the woman grabbing the apple, he offers to pluck the apple for her. And because he offers rather than just doing it, she tells him not to do it. And but there is then a moment of transformation in which she gives him bread and wine, and they make love underneath the tree. So there's a healing, a return from the error of Eden in this. And then she takes him along the broad and fertile. There's a moment of choice where you can either choose the road of wickedness or the road that some say is the road to heaven, which would be Trump's way. Or the road of a place of righteousness full of for thorns and briars, which would be the road of the ascetic monk. But actually what she takes him is she follows the ferny brae, follows the stream of life, which actually is the conjoined stream of the blood and the water. But it's fringed by the fern, which is the fractal plant, the magical plant, connected with the figure of John the Baptist. Because the fern is said to blossom on John the Baptist's day. And she takes him over the hill into the art. And when he returns, we don't know what happens to him where he returns, but he returns with the clad in green, with the shoes of green and the tongue that cannot lie. Now the Corpus Christi carol shows us the dynamics of what happens over the hill. So here we are presented really with this sense of the wasted land. So this is a primary thing you find with the Grail tradition, where you'll see it after lunch when I take us through the Grail sequence, where the world is wasted, very much like the world, where the world is struggling at the moment. So we go into this as the falcon, and the falcon is this great, in the Brythonic tradition, this magical bird that is the bird of the morning, that is connected to Gawain, who in the Welsh tradition is called Gwalchmai, who is the hawk of the maze, who is this energy of seeing and sight that represents the creation of new life, new possibilities. We see the hawk, as the hawk we fly over Brosselande, the magical forest, so we fly over Logres, the magical kingdom, and what we see is the wasted orchard and the ruined hall at the centre of the land. And so as we descend there, we find ourselves standing between these two streams, a river of shining white water, a river of golden red blood. And we see this ancient hall that was an important and beautiful place that is in ruins. And as we enter into the hall, we enter into the dynamics of transformation, the dynamics of the Grail. And what we see dimly, we've got a strong smell of frankincense, a sense of being in a sacred place. This hall that's covered in these rich tapestries of black and gold and purple. We see in the middle of the hall a great bed, a hawthorn tree that might be a dead hawthorn at the foot of the bed, the top of the bed a keystone. A stone that is the keystone of an arch with the words Corpus Christi, the body of Christ, carved into it. On the left side we have the figure of a weeping woman who is the who sews the shroud. On the right hand side, a hound that is jackal and hound. And on the bed, there is this wounded knight who is a kingly knight. And from his wounds, on one side is the stream of red gold blood, and the other is the stream of water. Now this is what my teacher Ernest would have called the lamb slain before the creation of the world. This is the primordial kind of sacrifice, the giving of life that all may live. It has a connection with the crucifixion of Christ, but when Christ is crucified, the spear is thrust into his side, and from there spring blood and water. It has a connection with the union of the human and the fairy realms, which we find in the two previous ballads, where the fairy is the, if you like, the kind of the white stream, the human is the red stream. And the important thing about the tableau is it is static, because the human being is needed. Because the human being who is this, the person that connects everything, is needed. So this is the grail question that is asked and that has to be asked in order for something to move. Here everything is suspended between life and death, apart from the constant flow of the two rivers, that in a certain sense are also the two pillars of the tree of life, that they represent all the aspects of duality. So they're blood and tears, they're the white rose and the red rose, they're life and death, they're fairy and human. And so in this place, and whatever you did in your meditation around this place, is significant for you and your part in that mystery. So even if you stood there and did nothing and just witnessed, that is your active part in the mystery. If you said something or did something, that is your part in the mystery. And as a result of the activity, even the act of the witnessing of the mystery, there is a shift, there is a movement. We see the flowering of the hawthorn tree, where the flow of the red and the white becomes strong. The hall, which is like an Anglo-Saxon wooden hall, becomes renewed and painted and glows with colour and beauty. Through the doors of the hall, we see that the orchard is in flower and will fruit. And this is, now we're going to look at this mystery in completely other symbolism as we come back from our lunch, because I'm going to look at it in the medieval version. But this is sort of the fundamental principle behind it. And in a certain way, really, you can take those three ballads, the Ballad of Tamlin, the Ballad of Thomas Rymer, and the Corpus Christi Carol, and see that they contain the whole of the mystery. We spend enough time with them. They're very, very concentrated, but the usefulness of the other stories is they amplify elements of that mystery. Okay, so we're at our lunchtime. Is anybody with something absolutely burning? Because the rest of the day to ask questions, but anybody's got something burning that they can't eat their lunch unless they ask the question, ask it now. No? Okie dokie. So, at 12 o'clock, so come back at 1:30, and We'll take you through another PowerPoint presentation focusing on the Path of the Grail, as expressed by Mallory. But I want you to bear in mind that all of the things that I've been talking about this morning as we look at this, and also bear in mind the sequence of the ballads, that's like more essentialized. version of that, because in a certain sense, if you think of Tamlin Valad as the incarnation of the magical child who brings newness into the world, if you think of the Thomas the Rhymer Valad as the undoing of the error of Eden, and the entrance into the art, and the Corpus Christi carol as the mystical dynamics of the Grail into art, that can help to orientate us in the great mass of symbolism and ideas that comes out of Mallory. Okay, good. So have a nice lunch. See you all at 1:30.
Thank you. Sue, you're muted.
Hi.
Jenny, you're muted.
I'm tired now.
Well,
interesting, wasn't it?
Oh. Not too much, really, for my brain to keep up with, but interesting, too.
I know. I think I can always listen to this again. And it get more bits in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.